The discovery came long before Nash had worked out the laborious steps of the actual proof. Nash always worked backward in his head. He would mull over a problem and at some point have a flash of insight, an intuition, a vision of the solution he was seeking. These insights typically came early on, as was the case, for example, with the bargaining problem, sometimes years before he was able, through prolonged effort, to work out a series of logical steps that would lead one to his conclusion. Other great mathematicians, Riemann, Poincaré, Wiener, have also worked in this way. One mathematician, describing the way he thought Nash's mind worked, said, "He was the kind of mathematician for whom the geometric visual insight was the strongest part of his talent. He would see a mathematical situation as a picture in his mind. Whatever a mathematician does has to be justified by a rigorous proof, but that's not how the solution presents itself to him. Instead, it's a bunch of intuitive threads that have to be woven together, and some of the early ones present themselves visually." With Steenrod's encouragement, Nash gave a short talk on his theorem at the International Congress of Mathematicians in Cambridge in September 1950. Judging from the published abstract, however, Nash was still missing essential elements of his proof. Nash planned to complete it at Princeton. Unfortunately for Nash, Steenrod was on leave in France. Lefschetz, who undoubtedly was pressing Nash to have the paper ready before the annual job market got underway in February, urged Nash to go to Donald Spencer, the visiting professor who had been on Nash's generals committee and had just been hired away from Stanford, and to use Spencer as a sounding board for completing the paper. As a visiting professor, Spencer occupied a tiny office squeezed between Artin's huge corner office and an equally grand study belonging to William Feller. Spencer, as Lefschetz wrote to the dean of faculty, was probably the most attractive mathematician in America at that moment, as well as one of the most versatile American-born mathematicians. A doctor's son, Spencer grew up in Colorado and was admitted to Harvard, where he intended to study medicine. Instead, he wound up at MIT studying theoretical aerodynamics, and then at Cambridge, England, where he became a student of J.E. Littlewood, Hardy's great co-author. Spencer did brilliant work in complex analysis, a branch of pure mathematics that has widespread engineering applications. He was a much sought-after collaborator, his most celebrated collaboration being with the Japanese mathematician Kunihiko Kodaira, a Fields medalist. Spencer himself won the Bocher Prize. Although he primarily worked in highly theoretical fields, he nonetheless had some applied interests, namely hydrodynamics. A lively, voluble man, Spencer was sometimes daunting in his reckless energy. His appetite for difficult problems was boundless, his powers of concentration impressive. He could drink enormous quantities of alcohol, 5 martinis out of birdbath glasses, and still talk circles around other mathematicians, a man whose natural exuberance hid a darker tendency toward depression and introspection. Spencer's appetite for abstraction was accompanied by an extraordinary empathy for colleagues who were in trouble. He did not, however, suffer fools gladly. The first draft of Nash's paper gave Spencer little confidence that the younger mathematician was up to the task he'd set for himself. "I didn't know what he was going to do, really, but I didn't think he was going to get anywhere." But for months, Nash showed up at Spencer's door once or twice a week. Each time he would lecture Spencer on his problem for an hour or two. Nash would stand at the blackboard writing down equations and expounding his points. Spencer would sit and listen and then shoot holes in Nash's arguments. Spencer's initial skepticism slowly gave way to respect. He was impressed by the calm, professional way that Nash responded to his most outrageous challenges and his fussiest objections. He wasn't offensive. He was absorbed in his work. He responded thoughtfully. He also liked Nash for not being a whiner. Nash never talked about himself, Spencer recalled. Unlike other students who felt underappreciated, he said, Nash never complained. The more he listened to Nash, moreover, the more Spencer appreciated the sheer originality of the problem. It was not a problem that somebody gave Nash. People didn't give Nash problems. He was highly original. Nobody else could have thought of this problem. Many breakthroughs in mathematics come from seeing unsuspected relationships between objects that seem intractable. and ones that mathematicians have already got their arms around. Nash had in mind a very broad category of manifolds, all manifolds that are compact, meaning that they're bounded and do not run off into infinity the way a plane does, but are self-enclosed, like a sphere, and smooth, meaning that they have no sharp bends or corners, as there are, for example, on the surface of a cube. His nice discovery, essentially, was that these objects were more manageable than they appeared at first glance, because they were in fact closely related to a simpler class of objects called real algebraic varieties, something previously unsuspected. Algebraic varieties are like manifolds, also geometric objects, but they are objects defined by a locus of points, described by one or more algebraic equations. Thus, x squared plus y squared equals 1 represents a circle in the plane, while x times y equals 1 represents a hyperbola. Nash's theorem states the following. Given any smooth, compact, k-dimensional manifold M, there exists a real algebraic variety V in R 2k plus 1, and a connected component W of V, so that W is a smooth manifold diffeomorphic to M to the 24th power. In plain English, Nash is asserting that for any manifold it is possible to find an algebraic variety one of whose parts corresponds in some essential way to the original object. To do this, he goes on to say, one has to go to higher dimensions. Nash's result was a big surprise, as the mathematicians who nominated Nash for membership in the National Academy of Sciences in 1996 were to write, "It had been assumed that smooth manifolds were much more general objects than varieties." Today, Nash's result still impresses mathematicians as beautiful and striking, quite apart from any applicability. "Just to conceive of the theorem was remarkable," said Michael Artin, professor of mathematics at MIT. Artin and Barry Mazur, a mathematician at Harvard, used Nash's result in a 1965 paper to estimate periodic points of a dynamical system. Just as biologists want to find many species distinguished by only minor differences to trace evolutionary patterns, mathematicians seek to fill in the gaps in the continuum between bare topological spaces at one end and very elaborate structures like algebraic varieties at the other. Finding a missing link in this great chain, as Nash did with this result, opened up new avenues for solving problems. "If you wanted to solve a problem in topology, as Mike and I did," said Mazur recently, "you could climb one rung of the ladder and use techniques from algebraic geometry." What impressed Steenrod and Spencer, and later on mathematicians of Artin and Mazur's generation, was Nash's audacity. First, the notion that every manifold could be described by a polynomial equation is a larger-than-life thought, if only because the immense number and sheer variety of manifolds would seem to make it inherently unlikely that all could be described in so relatively simple a fashion. Second, believing that one could prove such a thing also involves daring, even hubris. The result Nash was aiming for would have seemed too strong, and therefore improbable and unprovable. Other mathematicians before Nash had spotted relationships between some manifolds and some algebraic varieties, but had treated these correspondences very narrowly, as highly special and unusual cases. By early winter, Spencer and Nash were satisfied that the result was solid, and that the various parts of the lengthy proof were correct. Although Nash did not get around to submitting a final draft of his paper to the Annals of Mathematics until October 1951, Steenrod in any case vouched for the results that February, referring to a piece of research which he has nearly completed, and with which I am well acquainted, since he used me as a sounding board. Spencer thought game theory was so boring that he never bothered to ask Nash in the course of that whole year what it was that he had proved in his thesis. Nash's paper on algebraic manifolds, the only one he was ever truly satisfied with, though it was not his deepest work, established Nash as a pure mathematician of the first rank. It did not, however, save him from a blow that fell that winter. Nash hoped for an offer from the Princeton Mathematics Department. Although the department's stated policy was not to hire its own students, it did not, as a matter of practice, pass up ones of exceptional promise. Lefschetz and Tucker very likely dropped hints that an offer was a real possibility. Although most of the faculty other than Tucker neither understood nor displayed any interest in his thesis topic, they were aware that it had been greeted with respect by economists. In January, Tucker and Lefschetz made a formal proposal that Nash be offered an assistant professorship. Bochner and Steenrod were strongly in favor, although Steenrod, of course, was not present at the discussion. The proposal, however, was doomed to failure. No appointment could be made without unanimous support in a department as small as Princeton's, and at least three members of the faculty, including Emil Artin, voiced strong opposition. Artin simply did not feel that he could live with Nash, whom he regarded as aggressive, abrasive, and arrogant, in such a small department. Artin, who supervised the honors calculus program in which Nash taught for a term, also complained that Nash couldn't teach or get along with students. So the appointment wasn't offered. It was a bitter moment. The thought must have occurred to Nash that he was being rejected less on the basis of his work than on the basis of his personality. It was an even greater blow because the same faculty made it clear that it hoped that John Milner, only a junior at this time, would one day become part of the Princeton faculty. The job market, while not as bad as in the Depression, was nonetheless rather bleak, the Korean War having cut into university enrollments. Having been turned down by Princeton, Nash knew he would be lucky to get a temporary instructorship in a respectable department. Both MIT and Chicago, it turns out, were interested in hiring Nash as an instructor. Bochner had the ear of William Ted Martin, the new chairman of the MIT Mathematics Department, and strongly urged Martin to offer Nash an instructorship. Bochner urged Martin to ignore the gossip about Nash's supposedly difficult personality. Tucker, meanwhile, was pushing Chicago to do the same. When MIT offered Nash a CLE Moore instructorship, Nash, who liked the idea of living in Cambridge, accepted. Chapter 16, MIT. By the end of June, Nash was in Boston, living in a cheap room on the Boston side of the Charles. Every morning he walked across the Harvard Bridge, over the yellow-gray river, to East Cambridge, where MIT's modern, aggressively utilitarian campus lay sprawled between the river and a swath of factories and warehouses. Even before he reached the far side, he could smell the factory smells, including the distinct odors of chocolate and soap mingling together from a Necco candy factory and a P&G detergent plant. As he turned right onto Memorial Drive, he could see Building 2 looming ahead, a featureless block of cement painted an alarming brown just to the right of the new library, then under construction. His office was on the third floor next to the stairwell, in a corner suite assigned to several instructors, a spare, narrow room with a high ceiling overlooking the river and the low Boston skyline beyond. In 1951, before Sputnik and Vietnam, MIT was not exactly an intellectual backwater, but it was nothing like what it is today. The Lincoln Laboratory was famous for its wartime research, but its future academic superstars were still relatively unknown youngsters, and powerhouse departments for which it has since become known, economics, linguistics, computer science, mathematics, were either infants or gleams in some academic's eye. It was in spirit and in fact still very much the nation's leading engineering school, not a great research university. An environment more antithetical to the hothouse atmosphere of Princeton is hard to imagine. MIT's large scale and modern contours made it feel like the behemoth state universities of the Midwest. The military, as well as industry, loomed awfully large, so large that MIT's armed plainclothes campus security force existed solely for the purpose of guarding the half-dozen classified sites scattered around the campus and preventing those without proper security clearances and identification from wandering in. ROTC and courses in military science were required of all MIT's 2,000-plus undergraduate men. The academic departments, like mathematics and economics, existed pretty much to cater to the engineering student. In Paul Samuelson's words, a pretty crude animal. all counted as service departments, gas stations where engineers pulled up to get their tanks filled with obligatory doses of fairly elementary mathematics, physics, and chemistry. Economics, for example, had no graduate program at all until the war. Physics had no Nobel laureates on its faculty at the time. Teaching loads were heavy. 16 hours a week was not uncommon for senior faculty, and were weighted toward large introductory courses like calculus, statistics, and linear algebra. Its faculties were younger, less well-known, and less credentialed than Harvard's, Yale's, or Princeton's. "There were advantages," said Samuelson. "A lot of the MIT faculty didn't have PhDs. I came without a formal degree. Solo came before he had a formal degree. We were treated magnificently. It was more of a meritocracy." He added, "People would say, 'Doesn't everybody do that?' 'Not up the river,' we'd answer. How do you explain that? We're Avis, we try harder." Socially, MIT was dominated by an old guard, not of high society intellectuals, but of middle-class Republicans and engineers. "It certainly was not a faculty club populated by cultivated Brahmins," said Samuelson, who was then 25 years old. "When I came in 1940, it was 85% engineering, 15% science." MIT also had a less exclusionary tradition than Harvard or even Princeton. By the 1950s, perhaps 40% of the mathematics faculty and students at MIT were Jewish. Bright youngsters from New York City public schools, effectively barred even then from attending Princeton as undergraduates, went there. "Princeton was out of the question for a Jew," recalls Joseph Cohn, who enrolled as a freshman at MIT in 1950. "At Brooklyn Tech, the greatest thing in the world was sending a student to MIT." Still smarting from his rejection by Princeton, Nash arrived at Building 2 with something of a chip on his shoulder, a feeling that he was a swan among ducks. MIT was already changing, however. Indeed, bringing a brilliant young researcher like Nash on board in the mathematics department was itself a sign of that shift. There was money all of a sudden, not just for teaching the exploding numbers of students, but for research. The amounts were small by post-Sputnik standards or even those of today, but huge by pre-war standards. Support for science, initially fueled by the successes during World War II, was now growing because of the Cold War. It came not just from the Army, Navy, and Air Force, but from the Atomic Energy Commission and the Central Intelligence Agency. MIT wasn't unique. Other institutions, from the big state universities in the upper Midwest to Stanford, grew up the same way. There was also the talent. Physics got many of the Los Alamos people. Electrical engineering was becoming a magnet for the first generation of computer scientists, an eclectic group of neurobiologists, applied mathematicians, and assorted visionaries like Jerome Letvin and Walter Pitts, who saw the computer as a model for studying the architecture and functioning of the human brain. "It was very much a growing environment, and science was a growing sphere," said Samuelson, adding that after the war, the 85%-15% split between engineering and science had shifted to 50%-50%. He added, "It was the upswing in money that made this possible. That was part of the whole post-war pattern." Mathematics was on the verge of becoming an important department, although that was not obvious to everyone at the time. The department had one famous name, Norbert Wiener, who wound up at MIT largely thanks to Harvard's anti-Semitism, and two or three first-rate younger men, including the topologist George Whitehead and the analyst Norman Levinson. But otherwise, mathematics consisted largely of competent teachers rather than great researchers. A few giants, but a lot of mediocrities. The man who changed all that was appointed chairman of the department in 1947. William Ted Martin, called Ted by everyone who knew him, was the tall, skinny, loquacious son of an Arkansas country doctor. Blonde and blue-eyed, with a sunny disposition and a ready grin, Martin was married to the granddaughter of the president of Smith College and revved up with ambition. A man whose innate decency would turn him into one of Nash's protectors after Nash became ill, Martin would soon endure his own trial by fire. At the height of the McCarthy witch hunt, Martin's secret past as an underground member of the Communist Party in the late 1930s and early 1940s would be exposed, threatening both his career and his vision for the department. but in 1951 the past was still safely buried. A spark plug of a chairman, his real talent was for making things happen, wheedling money out of the MIT administration, the Navy, and the Air Force, and using it to great, indeed astounding, effect. One of Martin's strokes of genius was figuring out that the cheapest and quickest way to upgrade the department was not to reel in a few more big names, but to lure young hotshots there for a year or two, and handle them, as much as possible, with kid gloves. Copying Harvard's Benjamin Pierce fellows, Martin created CLE Moore Instructorships, so-called in honor of MIT's most distinguished mathematician in the 1920s. Moore instructors weren't expected to join the permanent faculty. The idea was to get a stream of talent that would act as a catalyst, firing up MIT's humdrum atmosphere and attracting better students, the best of whom now automatically went to the Ivies and Chicago. Since he wouldn't have to live with them for long, or so he thought, Martin wasn't scared of difficult personalities. Buckner said Nash was worth appointing. "Don't worry about anything," Martin recalled. And Martin didn't. He came to value Nash not just as a brilliant and creative young man, but as an ally in his quest to make the department great. He would come to particularly rely on Nash's absolute intellectual honesty. When Nash mentioned somebody as a potential hire, you didn't wonder if he was a crony or a relative. If Nash said he was top flight, you didn't need much in the way of outside references. The most attractive figure at MIT from Nash's point of view was Norbert Wiener. Wiener was in some ways an American John von Neumann, a polymath of great originality who made stunning contributions in pure mathematics up until the beginning of World War II, and then embarked on a second and equally astounding career in applied mathematics. Like von Neumann, Wiener is known to the public for his later work. He was, among other things, the father of cybernetics, the application of mathematics and engineering to communications and control problems. Wiener was also famously eccentric. His appearance alone was remarkable. His beard, Samuelson recalled after Wiener's death in 1964, was like the Ancient Mariner's. He puffed on fat cigars, he waddled like a duck, a myopic parody of an absent-minded professor. His extraordinary upbringing at the hands of his father Leo was the subject of two popular books, I Am a Genius and I Am a Mathematician, the first of which became a bestseller in the early 1950s. Prolific as he was, Wiener generated as many anecdotes about himself as theorems. He hardly seemed to know where he was. He would ask, for example, "When we met, was I walking to the faculty club or away from it? For in the latter case, I've already had my lunch." He was notoriously insecure. If he encountered someone he knew carrying a book under his arm, he would as likely as not ask anxiously whether his name was in the book. Friends and admirers traced this feature of his personality to his obsessive and overbearing father, who once bragged that he could turn a broomstick into a mathematician, and to Harvard's anti-Semitism, which cost Wiener an appointment in Birkhoff's department. As Samuelson said in a eulogy after Wiener's death, "The exodus from Harvard dealt a lasting psychic trauma to Norbert Wiener. It did not help that his father was a Harvard professor, or that Norbert's mother regarded his move as a cruel come-down in life." Wiener's colleagues at MIT knew that he suffered from periods of manic excitability, followed by severe depressions, constantly threatened to resign, and sometimes spoke of suicide. When he was high, he'd run all over MIT telling people his latest theorem, Zipporah Feige Levinson, the wife of Norman Levinson, recalled. You couldn't stop him. At times he would come to the Levinsons' house weeping and say that he wished to kill himself. One of Wiener's ever-present fears was that he would go mad. His brother Theo, as well as two nephews, suffered from schizophrenia. Perhaps because of his own psychological struggles, Wiener had an acute empathy for other people's trials. He was egotistical and childish, but also very sensitive to the real needs of others, Mrs. Levinson recalled. When a younger colleague was writing a book but couldn't afford a typewriter, Wiener showed up at his door unannounced with a Royal Portable under his arm. When Nash arrived at MIT in 1951, Wiener embraced him enthusiastically and encouraged Nash's growing interest in the subject of fluid dynamics, an interest that eventually led Nash to his most important work. For example, Nash sent Wiener a note in November 1952, inviting him to a seminar Nash was to give on turbulence via statistical mechanics, collision functions, etc. His postscript saying, "I've found the smoothing effect in definite form now," suggests that Nash talked about his research with Wiener, something he did with almost no one else in the department. Nash saw Wiener, a genius who was at once adulated and isolated, as a kindred spirit and fellow exile. He copied some of Wiener's more extreme mannerisms, his own form of homage to the older man. But Nash was to become far closer to Norman Levinson, a first-rate mathematician and a man of extraordinary character who would play a role in Nash's career similar to those of Steenrod and Tucker at Princeton, a combination of sounding board and father substitute. Levinson, then in his early 40s, was more enigmatic than Martin, but far more accessible than Wiener. Wiry, of medium height, with craggy features, Levinson was a fine teacher who rarely displayed the slightest facial expression and never referred to his own accomplishments. He suffered from hypochondria and from wide mood swings, long manic periods of intense creative activity, followed by months, sometimes years of depression, in which nothing interested him. A former communist like Martin, Levinson would suffer doubly during the McCarthy years when he endured not only notoriety and threats to his career as a mathematician, but his teenage daughters slide into mental illness. Despite these burdens, Levinson was, and would long remain, by far the most respected member of the department. Thoughtful, decisive, and attuned to the personal as well as intellectual needs of those around him. Levinson was father confessor and wise elder, the one whose judgments were constantly sought and carried most weight on everything from research to appointments. His personal history was one of individual triumph over bleak beginnings. Born in Lynn, Massachusetts, just before World War I, Levinson was the son of a shoe factory worker who earned $8 a week and whose education consisted of attending a yeshiva for a few years. His mother was illiterate. Despite a childhood of desperate poverty and an education that consisted of attending run-down vocational schools, Levinson's brilliance was undeniable. He managed, with the help of Wiener, who spotted his talent, to attend MIT and later Cambridge. At Cambridge, he became a protege of G.H. Hardy and embarked on a series of brilliant papers on ordinary differential equations. He was very uncouth, very provincial, his wife Zipporah, who met Levinson soon after he returned from England, recalled in 1995. He was highly opinionated and too ignorant to know that he didn't know everything, but he'd plunge in and make a good paper, despite the fact that he didn't know the literature. Wiener ignored his rough edges. Like many promising young Jewish mathematicians of his generation, Levinson had difficulty getting an academic post when he returned to the States, and it was Hardy who, while visiting Harvard in 1937, was ultimately responsible for Levinson's appointment that year at MIT. The university's provost, Vannevar Bush, had turned down Wiener's recommendation that Levinson be offered an assistant professorship when Hardy, who at that time was both an outspoken opponent of Nazi antisemitism and the most prominent member of the German Mathematical Society, went with Wiener to the provost's office to protest. "Tell me, Mr. Bush, do you think you're running an engineering school or a theological seminary?" he is supposed to have said. When the provost gave a puzzled frown, Harvey went on, "If it isn't, why not hire Levinson?" Nash was attracted by Levinson's strong personality and by a quality that he both shared and admired, namely Levinson's uncommon willingness to tackle new and difficult problems. Levinson was an early pioneer in the theory of partial differential equations, recognized by a Bocher Prize, and the author of an important theorem in the quantum theory of scattering of particles. Most remarkably, when he was in his early 60s and already suffering from the brain tumor that would eventually kill him, Levinson achieved the most important result of his career, the solution to a part of the famous Riemann hypothesis. In many ways, Levinson was a role model for Nash. Chapter 17, Bad Boys. "People considered him a bad boy, but a great one," Donald J. Newman, 1995. "The great man is colder, harder, less hesitating, and without fear of opinion. He lacks the virtues that accompany respect and respectability, and altogether everything that is the virtue of the herd. If he cannot lead, he goes alone. He knows he is incommunicable. He finds it tasteless to be familiar. When not speaking to himself, he wears a mask. There is a solitude within him that is inaccessible to praise or blame. Friedrich Nietzsche, The Will to Power. Nash was just 23 years old when he became an MIT instructor. He was not only the youngest member of the faculty, but younger than many of the graduate students. His boyish looks and adolescent behavior won him nicknames like Little Abner and the Kid Professor. By MIT standards of that time, the teaching duties of CLE Moore instructors were light, but Nash found them irksome nonetheless, as he did everything that interfered with his research or smacked of routine. Later, he would be one of the few active researchers on the faculty who avoided giving courses in his own research area. Partly it was a matter of temperament, partly a matter of calculation. He shrewdly realized that his advancement did not depend on how well or poorly he performed in front of students. He'd advise other instructors, "If you're at MIT, forget about teaching, just do research." Perhaps for this reason, Nash was mostly assigned required courses for undergraduates. In the 7 years of his teaching career at MIT, he seems to have taught only 3 graduate courses, all introductory, one in logic in his second year, one in probability, and a third in the fall of 1958 in game theory. Mostly, it seems, he taught different sections of undergraduate calculus. His lectures were closer to free association than exposition. Once he described how he planned to teach complex numbers to freshmen. "Let's see, I'd tell them I equals square root of minus one, but I'd also tell them that it could be minus the square root of minus one. Then, so how would you decide which one?" He started to wander. "Just what freshmen needed," the listener said in disgusted tones in 1995. He didn't care whether the students learned or not. He made outrageous demands and talked about subjects that were either irrelevant or far too advanced. He was a tough grader, too. At times, his ideas about the classroom had more to do with playing mind games than pedagogy. Robert Allman, who later became a distinguished game theoretician and was then a freshman at MIT, described Nash's escapades in the classroom as flamboyant and mischievous. Joseph Kohn, later the chairman of the Princeton Mathematics Department, called him a bit of a gamester. During the 1952 Stevenson-Eisenhower race, Nash was convinced, quite rightly as it turned out, that Eisenhower would win. Most of the students supported Stevenson. He made elaborate bets with the students that were constructed so that he would win regardless of who won the election. The very brightest students were amused, but most were frightened away, and soon the better-informed students started to avoid his courses altogether. In his first year at MIT, Nash taught an analysis course for advanced undergraduates. The course was supposed to be an introductory look at calculus, in which students weren't just learning manipulations, but rather absolutely solid proofs of statements, and how to construct such proofs. Between the first and second semesters of the year-long course, the number of students dwindled from about 30 to 5. Kohn called. He gave a one-hour test. He handed out blue books where you filled in your name and the course number on the cover. When the bell rang, you were supposed to turn over the exam sheet and start working on the test. There were 4 problems. Problem number 1 was, "What is your name?" The other 3 problems were fairly hard. Since I knew by then how his mind worked, I made sure to write next to number 1, "My name is Joseph Kohn." People who assumed that writing their name on the cover was enough got 25 points taken off. Putting classic unsolved problems on exams was another of Nash's favorite tricks, Allman recalled. The students were supposed to show that pi is an irrational number. Later, when Nash was upbraided by the chairman of the department for putting the equivalent of Fermat's last theorem on a final, he responded by saying that people have a mental picture that this is a difficult problem. Maybe that's the stumbling block. Maybe if people didn't realize that the problem was hard, they could solve it. On another occasion, one of Nash's graders actually confronted him after he put the following question on a test. "If you make up a bunch of fractions of pi, 3.141592, etc. If you start from the decimal point, take the first digit, and place the decimal point to the left, you get 0.1. Then take the next two digits, 0.41. Then take the next three digits, 0.592. And so on and so on. You get a sequence of fractions between 0 and 1. What are the limit points of this set of numbers? A limit point is a point such that in any open interval containing it, however small, there are an infinite number of numbers from the sequence. The grader immediately realized that it was a question that nobody had ever answered. The decimal expansion of pi isn't a famous, outstanding problem, but it's the kind of thing mathematicians ask each other, not undergraduates. Only one fact has been proved, namely that it has to have at least one limit point. It was clear that the students should know that there was at least one limit. But Nash thought that he knew intuitively that every number between 0 and 1 should be a limit point. He felt strongly that he knew the answer intuitively, which is of course quite different from having a solid proof. "It was a sort of strange thing to do," said the grader in 1996. Nash's propensity for tricks of this kind was so well known that it became the occasion of a small joke on him. George Whitehead, a topologist in the department at the time, recalled in a conversation in 1995. Nash was teaching a large section of the same freshman calculus course that several graduate students were also teaching. All the sections had a prescribed and identical final, and all the tests were graded together. A test signed J. Forbes Hacker Jr. with all wrong answers came back, Hacker being a double entendre referring both to Nash's favorite put-down, which was hack, and MIT slang for jokester. It was hackers, for example, who one night removed a car belonging to Donald Spencer, who was briefly an instructor at MIT before the war, from its parking space on Massachusetts Avenue, deconstructed it, and left it for him to find when he walked into his classroom the next morning, once again fully assembled. On another occasion, messages appeared on several blackboards around Building 2. "This is Hate John Nash Day." Still, Nash could be charming to students he regarded as mathematically talented, and such students found much to admire. To a select few, often undergraduates, Nash made himself very, very available for chatting about mathematics. Barry Major, a number theorist at Harvard who first encountered Nash during his freshman year at MIT, recalled. It was amazing what he was willing to talk about. There was a sense of infinite time in every conversation. Once Major and Nash were chatting in the common room, someone mentioned a classical theorem by a disciple of Gauss, Peter Gustave Lejeune Dirichlet, that states that there are an infinite number of prime numbers in certain arithmetic progressions. "It's the kind of thing that one just accepts or perhaps goes off and looks up afterward," Major said. Nash, however, jumped up, went to the board, and for hours and hours elegantly thought through the proof from first principles, for Major's benefit. Outside the classroom, Nash alternated between the sort of behavior for which he was famous at Princeton, pacing in Building 2's cavernous hallways whistling Bach, and bouts of sociability. By day, he spent very little time in the office suite that he shared with the other Moore instructors. Mostly he spent his time in the mathematics common room, a far cry from the one in Fine Hall, a ratty and nondescript lounge directly below the instructors' offices at the bottom of a flight of stairs. The social atmosphere of the MIT common room resembled some of the more raucous scenes from the cult movie If, about a British public school that is taken over by its boys. Nash imported the Princeton practice of a regular tea hour to MIT, but not any of its more genteel customs. He wanted to be the quickest, Isidore M. Singer, a fellow Moore instructor, recalled in 1994. He was a real competitor. Just as he had at Princeton, Nash liked jumping into a conversation, throwing out challenges, and being challenged. He liked solving problems. Students and an occasional professor played games, including Go, chess, a great favorite of Wiener's despite lack of skill at the game, and bridge. Nash, Singer recalled, was hopeless at bridge. "It was absurd," Singer said. He had no sense of the laws of probability in cards. Many of the games, however, were made up on the spur of the moment. One day, a group made up an index of eccentricity by which various department members were ranked. Wiener, not Nash, drew the highest score. Another time, everyone played a version of charades that involved drawing abstract pictures representing people around the department. A graduate student drew a highly elaborate picture of what appeared to be a taxi. Nobody could guess who it was supposed to be. The picture, it turned out, was meant to be a Nash, the car manufactured in the 1940s and 1950s, and was supposed to signify Nash the Hack, again a reference to Nash's favorite put-down of those he regarded as plotters. The crowd in the common room was dominated by a handful of fast-talking, wise-cracking veterans of Stuyvesant High School and the Bronx High School of Science math teams, and the City College math table, a once-famous table in City's cafeteria at which an entire generation of math students, mostly working-class Jews and immigrants, honed their skills in problem-solving and repartee. It was a brasher, rougher crowd, less uptight and more tolerant than the one in Fine Hall, and an audience more to Nash's liking. Showing off wasn't regarded as a crime if you knew your stuff. Lack of social graces was considered part and parcel of being real mathematicians. Their attitudes were famously non-bourgeois, exhibitionistic, dissolute, Felix Browder recalled. If anything, all of them placed a certain premium on eccentricity and outrageousness, although by today's standards what went for unconventional behavior and manners was by and large mild, depending on certain turns of phrase, brands of humor, and little deviations in dress. One fellow insisted on wearing pants with fly buttons with a button or two undone. One graduate student recalled, "At that time we thought of eccentricity and being good in math as going together. We were all enjoying ourselves by being a little bit wild. We thought of ourselves as taking advantage of being bright by ignoring conventions we didn't like. We turned ourselves a little bit into characters." In this circle, Nash learned to make a virtue of necessity, styling himself self-consciously as a free thinker. He announced that he was an atheist. He created his own vocabulary. He began conversations in midstream with, "Let's take this aspect." He referred to people as humanoids. Nash picked up the mannerisms of other eccentric geniuses. For example, Wiener, who was terribly nearsighted, would keep one of his fingers in the groove in the walls between the wall tiles and the plaster as he navigated his way hesitantly through the corridors. Nash did the same thing. D.J. Newman condemned all music after Beethoven. Nash would stalk into the music library and tell anyone who was listening to anything more modern, "That's junk." Levinson, whose daughter suffered from manic depression, hated psychiatrists. Nash adopted a similarly vehement stance against the profession. Warren Ambrose detested conventional greetings like, "How are you?" Nash followed suit. Marvin Minsky, whom Nash had known during his final year in Princeton and whom he regarded as the most intelligent humanoid of all, recalled, "We shared a similarly cynical view of the world. We'd think of a mathematical reason for why something was the way it was. We thought of radical mathematical solutions to social problems." At one point, Nash suggested a complete transfusion for something. If there was a problem, we were good at finding a really ridiculously extreme solution. One time, he said that parents should self-destruct, that is, commit suicide and hand over all their holdings to their children. It would be not only convenient, but principled, Nash said, according to Herta Newman, the wife of Nash's friend Donald Newman. Another time he told a class of undergraduates that American citizens' voting rights should be made proportional to their income, or perhaps it was wealth. In many ways, Nash's views were more suited to 19th-century England's elitist political landscape than to the predominantly left-wing counterculture of the MIT math department of the 1950s. Nevertheless, he adopted a touch of flamboyance about his dress. He wore translucent white Dacron shirts, sans undershirt, others thought to show off his powerful physique. He bought a camera and spent much of his time browsing through photography books. For a time he read and talked a great deal about experimenting with mind-altering drugs like heroin, although there is no evidence that he ever tried any. His growing heterogeneity of interests and heterodoxy could, with hindsight, be seen as the first overt signs of a growing alienation from convention and society that would later evolve into a radical sense of separateness and disconnection. But at the moment, these postures enhanced rather than detracted from Nash's social appeal. Nash's status as an instructor and his growing reputation as a mathematician brought him newfound respect. He was now considered interesting company. His arrogance was seen as evidence of his genius, and so was his eccentricity, a source of both amusement and grudging respect, the other side of the genius coin, as it were. Peggy Levinson, the department's den mother, said in 1996, "For Nash to deviate from convention is not as shocking as you might think. They were all prima donnas. If a mathematician was mediocre, he had to toe the line and be conventional. If he was good, anything went." Jerome Neuwirth, a graduate student at MIT, said, "When your solution turns out to be right, we give you your due. We give you a lot of leeway. Had Nash been less of a mathematician, he wouldn't have gotten away with his nastiness." Donald Newman added, "People were annoyed with him because he was flippant, but not really annoyed. They considered him a bad boy, but a great one. A great golden boy." The gang around Nash included Newman, a.k.a. DJ, a Harvard graduate student who spent most of his time at MIT hanging out with his old friends from City College, and with Nash, because Harvard was too snooty. Other members of the group included Walter Weissblum, a brilliant, sad sack, drunk and hunchback with a heart of gold, who never finished his degree. Harry Gonshore, who later became a professor at Rutgers, an oddball who wore Coke-bottle glasses, looked as if he were floating on air, and once proved a theorem so that it could be stated as AFL equals CIO. Gustav Salomon, the most humane of the group, later a co-inventor of the Reed-Solomon Code. Leopold Poldi Flatto, an inveterate people-watcher and storyteller. And after 1952, Jacob Leon Bricker, the group's Woody Allen. Neuwirth, a latecomer to the group, said, "Who were we? What were we trying to do? Every group has its own currency. Our only currency is what we were thinking. Who's smart? Who's doing what? What can you solve? How far did you get?" It doesn't sound nice, but it was exciting. Nash's closest equal in brains, competitiveness, and general superciliousness was Newman. Newman was considered a genius and the best problem solver of the group. A big, brash, blonde swaggerer, Newman had the distinction, very impressive to Nash, of being a 3-time Putnam winner. He was already a husband and father with responsibilities that, however, did little to cramp his flamboyant style. He drove a flashy white Thunderbird with red leather seats that he liked to drag race along Memorial Drive in the middle of the night. As an undergraduate at City College, he'd been famous for stunts like turning up in the class of some unfortunate mathematics professor bearing an enormous tree branch, leaves and all, that he claimed was for a biology class. Nash and Newman immediately recognized each other as kindred spirits. "They loved to spark each other," Singer recalled. "They admired each other's sarcasm," said Maddock. It was all good-natured. But DJ could make cracks much faster. He had instant recall when it came to mathematics. People used to say that DJ could solve any problem that could be done in 24 hours. Newman didn't have the power of Nash's sustained concentration. Nash could think about a problem for half a year. Newman went to a seminar given by Nash. "I sat in on some of Nash's lectures," said Newman, who was intrigued rather than put off. It was different, kind of exciting. He wandered, unlike most lecturers, because he liked to explore a lot of things at once. It was kind of nice. "We chewed each other out," Newman recalled. "Nash and I were friendly friends." Thanks to the acceptance of Newman and his friends, Nash acquired a real social life. The crowd often ate lunch together in Walker Memorial, but it also gathered after hours at various cheap restaurants, coffee shops, and beer halls that were as plentiful in 1950s Cambridge and Boston as they are today. Places that didn't mind if you nursed a beer all night and were willing to write separate checks. They included famous Boston restaurants like Durgan Park, which served generous helpings of traditional New England dishes, including a sinfully delicious roast beef and Indian pudding. Jake Worth, an old-style German establishment with a mammoth oak bar, and the Verst House in Harvard Square. Other favorites were Cronin's, Shea Dreyfus, and the Newbury Steakhouse. The Hayes Bickford and the Waldorf, which were both Horn and Hardart-style coffee shops, open most of the night, were also frequent gathering places. At other times, everybody would hang out at some graduate student's apartment or go to parties given by the Martins, Levinsons, and, in the mid-1950s, the Minskys. Within his new circle, Nash strove to constantly underscore his own uniqueness, superiority, and self-sufficiency. "I'm Nash with a capital N," his whole manner shouted. He was always saying that only one or two people in the department, Wiener was always one of these, were up to his standard. His put-downs were legendary. "You're a child," was a favorite expression. "You don't know crap. How trivial. How stupid. You'll never do anything," he would say. He loved to perform. At parties, he acted rather than conversed. Once at the Minskys, Nash demanded that his listeners challenge him with a difficult mathematical problem. He said, "I've had a few drinks. Are my thinking powers stronger or weaker on drink?" He was not above dissembling slightly to wow an audience. He would pout if he was bested in an argument. And he hated being challenged by someone he considered to be an inferior. One day in the common room, a group of students was talking about a famous World War II logistics puzzle, the Jeep problem. The essence of the Jeep problem is that you want to cross the 2,000-mile-wide Sahara Desert, but the Jeep's gas tank holds only enough gas to travel 200 miles. The only way to cross the desert is to follow a two-steps-forward, one-step-back strategy. To load up the Jeep with cans of gasoline, drive, say, 100 miles, drop off the cans, and go back to the starting point. Then you get more cans of gas, go 100 miles, unload some, and use some to top off the gas in the tank, go another 100 miles and go back, picking up some more gasoline. The question is, how many gallons would be needed? There is no optimal solution to the problem, as it turns out. Everybody was proposing solutions. Nash threw out a number. Nash's greater that term, Seymour Haber, proposed a number half as big. Nash contemptuously dismissed Haber's solution. When Haber insisted that he prove it, Nash said, "My solution's much better." Haber recounted, "I didn't see it. I insisted that he prove it. He didn't want to. He said it was obvious. I still wouldn't accept his assertion. So he did the calculation. He turned out to be mostly right, but he was extremely annoyed with me. He was angry for my having forced him to do this grungy work when it was perfectly clear all along what the answer was. He was angry with me for some period after that." Nor was he above putting the audience down. A typical example, at lunch one day, a graduate student was describing an axiomatic approach to a problem outlined by one of his professors. Nash fairly exploded. "Don't give me all that crap. Tell me how you'd solve the problem. You haven't learned anything. All these concepts don't mean a thing." Nash's put-downs of other mathematicians earned him the sobriquet Nash with a G. Nash responded, "G obviously stands for genius. In fact, there are a few geniuses these days here at MIT. Me, of course, and also Norbert Wiener. Even Norbert may no longer be a genius, but there is evidence that he once was." After that, he referred to GNU, Newman, and G-squared, Andrew Gleason, a young Harvard professor who had just solved Hilbert's fifth problem. When John McCarthy, whom Nash knew from Princeton, gave a seminar in the department, Nash pulled him aside afterward and said, "There are too many journals. There are too many trashy papers being published. There are too many guys doing research. Only a few of us should be in research. The rest of them should be in Sin X," a snide reference to the tables at the back of high school trigonometry books. Nash flaunted his social snobbery, a legacy of his Bluefield upbringing. He implied that he came from old money. He would sniff wine at a party and say, "This is an adequate Chianti." Nowhere was his snobbery more evident than in his reaction to being a non-Jew in a definitely Jewish atmosphere. Later, when Nash became paranoid and embraced all sorts of strange delusions, he wrote letters to Newman and others addressed to Jew Boy, became obsessed with the State of Israel, and talked about crypto-Zionist conspiracies. But in the early 1950s, his attitude was merely one of social superiority. He frequently told Newman that he looked too Jewish. Like Groucho Marx, he was inclined not to admire any club that accepted him. Nash displayed a contempt for people and things he considered beneath him. As Fred Brower, another instructor at MIT, put it 40 years later, "That covered a lot of territory." Chapter 18. Experiments. Rand, Summer 1952. One afternoon, during Nash's second summer in Santa Monica, he and Harold N. Shapiro, another mathematician from Rand, were swimming in the surf off Santa Monica Beach just south of the pier. The ocean was fairly rough. Below the breakwater, Santa Monica Beach was a narrow and steep strip of sand with breakers that were usually 6 to 10 feet high. It was a favorite of body surfers. Nash and Shapiro were far from shore when they were caught in a powerful current that swept them farther out. Both men were strong swimmers. Nash was built like a Greek god, Shapiro recalled, and he too was sturdy and muscular. But Shapiro remembers being dragged under the waves, briefly overpowered by the current, and very frightened. Nash seemed to be struggling as well. "It was hard work getting back to shore," Shapiro said. When the two young men finally reached the beach, they threw themselves on the sand, exhausted and breathing heavily. Shapiro recalled lying there thinking how lucky they were not to have drowned. To his amazement, however, Nash jumped to his feet after a moment or two and announced he was going back into the water. "I wonder if that was an accident," Nash said in a calm and detached tone. "I think I'll go back in and see." At the beginning of that second summer, Nash had driven cross-country from Bluefield to Santa Monica in a rusty old Dodge. He and John Milner, who was by now a graduate student at Princeton, made the trip together, though Milner drove his own car. Traveling with them were Nash's younger sister Martha and Ruth Hinks, a journalism major at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, who joined them at the last minute. They met in Chapel Hill, then drove on to Bluefield. Hinks remembers being warned not to let slip that Martha would be sharing the apartment with Milner as well as Nash. She recalled in 1997 that this secretiveness struck her as strange. As they started out, Ruth drove with Nash, Martha with Milner. Ruth was struck by Nash's complete indifference to her. "I was slim, attractive, intelligent," she recalled in 1997. "Nash never even noticed that I was there," she said. She was also struck by the seemingly distant relationship between Nash and Milner. "They just sort of stood around. They could have met the day before. They never referred to shared experiences. They didn't seem to really know each other." Even the relationship between brother and sister seemed a little standoffish, not affectionate at all, said Ruth. "I don't think I saw any affection from anybody on that trip." They traveled on U.S. 40, which took them through Kansas and Nebraska. They stopped once for a day in Grand Lakes, Colorado, where they all went horseback riding, and also in Salt Lake City, where they visited the Mormon Temple. The men put the young women in charge of divvying up all the motel, restaurant, and gas bills. All should have been fine for these young people, privileged as few were in 1952 to be traveling cross-country on their own. Yet before the trip was over, Nash and Ruth had quarreled, and Martha, who had been riding with Milner, was forced reluctantly to ride with her older brother for the remainder of the journey. It started as a fine adventure. Martha had just graduated from Chapel Hill and had traveled very little before. Tall and striking like her brother, Martha was extremely intelligent. In spite of a fierce determination not to be regarded as an egghead and an oddball, Martha had won a Pepsi-Cola scholarship by beating every boy at Beaver High on the SATs, and had received invitations to apply to Radcliffe, Smith, and other top women's schools. Her father, however, had turned down the scholarship on her behalf, saying that the family could afford tuition at a nearby school, and Martha wound up at St. Mary's, a junior college attended mostly by well-to-do Southern girls who brought fur coats with them, rode horses, and were themselves being groomed not for the job, but for the marriage market. After graduating from St. Mary's, she went on to the University of North Carolina, where she completed a teaching degree.